Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the broadcast this afternoon, risky banks, recalled cars, and dumped steel. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 26th of June. Great to have you with us, everybody. I know it is 5+ years past the financial crisis and 4 years since the official end of the Great Recession. So you would think that lessons have been learned and attitudes adjusted. Sadly, not so. There is a report out from the Comptroller of the Currency today saying that banks and other lenders are starting to embrace once again that scariest of banking words, risk. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Darren Benhart is with the Comptroller of the Currency, and he has a warning.
We're seeing increasing credit risk building within the system, which is manifest itself in weaker underwriting.
Weaker underwriting, meaning weaker standards, in car loans, for example.
Weaker credit being underwritten and increasing average losses on autos when loans do go bad.
And a similar thing is happening with corporations, especially risky ones. Banks appear more willing to overlook just how indebted corporate borrowers are when they look at how much a borrower owes versus how much they make.
They're approximately back to 2007 levels.
And lastly,
we've seen increasing use of covenant-lite loans.
A covenant in a loan just means that if you're a company borrowing money, every now and then you have to pass financial tests,
which require a borrower to maintain a certain level of financial solvency.
This is Stephen Miller with Standard & Poor's. For a lender, it's like having a canary in the coal mine. If a company hits trouble and can't pass the test 1 month,
lenders would come back and say, okay, well, we need you to pay a fee and we need some stepped up spread to compensate us for the fact that you're not as in good financial shape as you used to be.
Covenant-lite loans, of which there are many more these days, don't have that protection for lenders if a borrower defaults.
These are things we saw in the run-up to the financial crisis on housing.
Annette Admati is a professor at Stanford School of Business.
Bad standards for lending that got banks into trouble when borrowers couldn't pay and harmed the economy all around.
So instead of having a canary in the coal mine, people just start passing out around you. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
One is now officially obliged to wonder how long GM can keep going like it's going. General Motors is said to be getting ready to recall another 33,000 cars. Small change, yes, compared to the millions already recalled, but still, come on. This time, it's the Chevy Cruze. Faulty airbags are the culprit, and adding urgency is this fact that the Cruze is GM's most popular passenger car. Kate Davidson reports.
GM has recalled 20 million vehicles this year. The suspect Chevy Cruzes have a potential problem with airbags from Japanese supplier Takata. Still listening? Because auto analyst Marianne Keller says much of the public isn't. They're too saturated with recall news.
Consumers in general just sort of glaze over when they hear these things. As long as it's, you know, not affecting a car that perhaps is in their driveway or a car that they wanted to buy.
That's one reason GM's sales have just chugged along, and Keller doesn't expect this time to be any different. GM has told dealers to freeze sales of the problem Cruzes, but Morningstar analyst David Whiston says there's recent proof that temporarily halting sales might not matter. In fact, just last month,
GM did a stop delivery order on their large crossovers like the Buick Enclave,
the GMC Acadia, the Chevy Traverse, and you know what? GM still did well, really well.
In May, it was GM's best month of sales since August of 2008. So honestly, I mean, GM's product is just outstanding right now in all vehicle segments.
The stop sale order won't really hit GM's bottom line, but the timing is bad for somebody, says Michelle Krebs, a senior analyst with Autotrader.com.
That hurts the dealers because the bulk of a month's sales occur at the end of the month.
It's not just the end of the month, it's the end of the quarter. Now's the time some dealers are trying to hit sales targets to get bonuses from GM. It's a tough time not to be selling the company's most popular car. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Two words on Wall Street today, you guys: go and pro. The camera maker jumped 30% on its first day of trading. The broader markets, lucky to break even. Honestly, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the things you probably don't think too much about, that you just expect to be there when you want it, along with electricity, is water. But if the contamination problems this spring in West Virginia and its water company, West Virginia American Water, have taught us anything, it's that sometimes water isn't there for you.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
So on today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office, Susan Story, the CEO of American Water. Susan, it's good to have you here.
Thanks, Kai. It's great to be here.
I was going to start with a question about how this is a tough time to be in the water business. But really, sitting where I sit in Los Angeles without a whole lot of water seems like a pretty good time. It's the coming scarce commodity, right?
That's exactly right, Kai. In fact, there are two overarching concerns that we have about water in this country. One is the aging infrastructure, and the second one is water supply.
Talk to me for a second about that infrastructure. And one can't talk to the CEO of American Water without talking about West Virginia and the pipe problems and the leakage and all of that stuff. How do we prevent that from happening again?
Kai, I think the important thing, and we're very supportive of this, is to ensure that we have appropriate legislation and regulatory oversight to ensure that we don't have the leaks in the first place.
With all respect, you're not actually saying you need legislation and regulation to make sure that water is safe and you don't have leaks and all that, right?
No. What we're saying is the regulation of chemical storage, chemical production are monitored for. They're required to be monitored for. We do. At the same time, with as many compounds, you know, it is extremely difficult, if not technically infeasible, to monitor for everything at one time. So we back up and we say, how's the best way to avoid this happening again?
Other than infrastructure repairs and the sheer lack of water in some parts of this country, what is the thing that you have your eye on that the rest of us civilians don't even know is coming yet?
Many people look at our industry as being slow and not really high tech when the opposite is actually the truth. When you look at the smart water grid and how we can affect changes that will allow us to do even better real-time monitoring of potential leaks and stop them before they happen, that's one thing. The second thing is related to the water supply. I mean, most people believe the water comes from the sky. We drink it. They don't think about what it takes to treat it and to move it. And while you would think there would be a million different options, you know, pretty much you've got groundwater and you've got surface water, rivers, etc. If those aren't adequate, then you have to look at things like reuse or desalination.
You know, we did a story on toilet to tap, which is what you're dancing around but not really saying. And people, there's a big squishiness factor there, right?
There is. People recoil at times at the thought of toilet to tap, but not so much toilet to turf. So what we're going after is the toilet to turf or the toilet to flushing again. If you can reuse that water for purposes that don't have what you call the squishy or ick factor, then we think that we've made some significant progress.
So here comes a totally random question. How come my internet bill at my house is hundreds of dollars a month, internet and cable put together, but my water bill, I mean, it's peanuts? That doesn't make any sense with this resource that we have that you know, is running out.
Well, you've just pinpointed a key issue, Kai, and that is the value of water and the fact that water is immensely inexpensive, and by the time you treat it, you deliver it, there's not really an appropriate price. You know, we take for granted in this country the fact that we're going to have clean and safe and reliable water, and that's a luxury, and I don't think we appreciate it, nor do we value it appropriately.
When you go to a restaurant and you get water served at the table, do you kind of think, oh, yeah, that's me. I did that.
Well, two things. When I go to a restaurant and have water served at the table, I always ask for tap water, even if it's not the water we serve. And in our buildings, we don't allow bottled water. We drink our water out of the tap because it's good enough for our customers, it's good enough for us, so we don't allow bottled water in our offices.
Susan Story, she is the CEO of American Water. Susan, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai, very much.
Technology and popular uprisings have shown a remarkable affinity the past couple of years. Think Twitter in Iran and during the Arab Spring a couple of years ago. Governments work to shut those things down. Creative types figure out how to get around the censors. Cat and mouse is the phrase you're looking for here. The latest app to keep a step ahead of censors is called FireChat. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
The guys who designed FireChat expected the app would be used to maintain internet access when there is no internet connection. Christoph Dolligalt handles sales for FireChat.
We provide more access time to the internet, in average 44 minutes per day when people would not have been able to access the internet.
In addition to being used by U.S. kids wanting to extend their access to internet games, he's seeing huge demand from people in repressive countries.
In the past week, we've seen more than 40,000 downloads in Iraq alone, and the numbers in Iran are very comparable.
They like FireChat because it lets them communicate anonymously and without being censored by the government. FireChat relies on something called mesh networking. Mark Rotenberg with the Electronic Privacy Information Center explains how it works.
Mesh networking is basically creating a network among devices that can be easily linked together without relying on the larger internet.
In the case of FireChat, it uses Bluetooth to connect smartphones directly, but it's limited in range to only 200 feet.
What FireChat has done is scratch the surface.
Devabhaktuni Shri Krishna founded a wireless mesh networking company called Tropos.
The technology exists to make this far more powerful and effective.
He says the range could soon increase to connect smartphones separated by as much as a mile. For people trying to avoid government censors or just milking a few more minutes of game time. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
a lot of these countries that are jumping into our market, I can't even make the product for what they're selling.
Steel, U.S. steel. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off a 10% today, 21 points, closed at 16,846. Did the blue chips, the S&P 500 also down a 10%, that is 2 points, closed at 1957. The NASDAQ was flat, ended where it started, 4379. Financial firms were rattled after news that the British bank Barclays was being sued by New York's attorney general. Something about misleading investors and high-frequency trading? I don't know. Barclays raised more than 6% today. Morgan Stanley backed up 1%. Barnes & Noble's decision to separate its Nook business from its consumer book business. United investors on the sell side. The stock lost 0.5%. General Motors down 0.5% today as well on news of that coming recall. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note is at 2.53%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its final June consumer sentiment survey. Fashion designer Vera Wang turns 65. She's famous for all those gorgeous wedding gowns. And all across the country, people eat popcorn in the dark. Transformers: Age of Extinction explodes onto the big screen. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is trouble brewing between the world's second and third largest economies again. Both China and Japan claim a chain of islands in the East China Sea. Actually, a couple of other countries claim those islands as well. But caught in the middle of the whole thing is a teeny tiny resort island called Ishigaki. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports that the people of Ishigaki are stuck between worrying about the Chinese military and making money off big-spending Chinese tourists.
If you took a pin and pressed it into a world map, the hole would dwarf the size of the tiny island of Ishigaki in the East China Sea. The lush island is 150 miles off the coast of Taiwan, and although it's part of Japan, it's 1,000 miles away from Tokyo. It's surrounded by coral reef and turquoise water, making it one of the best diving spots in Asia.
Okay, next, the fins. Fin is a very useful gear.
Tour operator Anichi Miyazato uses his broken English to prepare a group of foreign tourists for a dive. In the distance, a fleet of Japanese Coast Guard ships loom over fishing and tour boats in Ishigaki's tiny harbor. They're here to patrol a chain of islands the Japanese call the Senkaku and the Chinese call the Diaoyu, just 100 miles away.
We have to protect our nations, our land. Please go away, Chinese military.
But it seems the Chinese military is here to stay. Just 2 weeks ago, video footage surfaced of a Chinese fighter jet flying less than 100 feet away from Japanese jets over the disputed islands. Late last year, China's government declared the airspace over the islands as its exclusive area, requiring other aircraft to identify themselves. The U.S. responded by flying two B-52 bombers through the area, unannounced. Below, among the sugarcane fields and palm trees of Ishigaki Island, tour operators watched the escalation, worried about how it would impact their business and wondering when the first shot would be fired.
Personally, I think it's inevitable.
Tour operator Mike Quinn, one of the few Americans on the island, says he's preparing for the worst.
For the first time a missile is fired or the Chinese overrun the Senkaku Islands, a lot of tours are going to be canceled. It's going to affect the bottom line big time.
For tiny Ishigaki, it's the ultimate China conundrum, bracing for an invasion by China's military while courting an invasion of Chinese tourists. Ishigaki's bustling new airport, complete with runways that can accommodate jumbo jets, opened last year. There are already flights to and from Taiwan. As of now, Ishigaki isn't on the radar of the world's fastest-growing tourist population in mainland China, but Hirohito Kakazu, who plans tourism for the island's government, would like to change that.
Japan's population is shrinking, and domestic tourism to the island will decline, so we need to develop tourism from elsewhere. That's why we built a new airport.
Kakazu is working on establishing routes from mainland China. A charter flight from Shanghai is planned for the fall. Ichiro Ohama, president of the local entrepreneurs club, says once Chinese tourists arrive to this subtropical paradise, they'll forget all about politics.
If there were a plane from Shanghai, it would only take a couple of hours, and then suddenly you're surrounded by nature, fresh air. You can catch and eat fresh fish, and you've got some of the best diving in the world. These are things you can't find in China.
It's that proximity to China that has defined local attitudes in Ishigaki. Older residents who were born here see China as an old friend. The island is part of Okinawa, which has maintained historical and cultural connections with China. Shigeo Arakaki owns a noodle shop on the island. He's a retired assistant to a member of Japan's parliament. He'd like to see a more diplomatic approach to resolving the dispute.
I think Japan and China should explore how to jointly develop the islands rather than fight over them.
At the moment, this solution doesn't look likely. Ishigaki Mayor Yoshitaka Nakayama.
China is becoming more aggressive and they're invading our territory. These are Japan's islands, and by international law, that's a fact. This is non-negotiable.
Japan's government is considering the construction of a military base on Ishigaki, and it's hired local fishing boats to help patrol the disputed islands and ward off Chinese vessels. Still, back on his boat over a coral reef, diving tour operator Anichi Miyazaki says sharing the islands might not be such a bad idea. China and Japan could combine forces to build something on those uninhabited rocks that would attract tourists. Maybe a theme park.
I don't know. Disneyland? I don't
know. Miyazaki says we're all businessmen on this island, and war is never good for business. Reporting from Ishigaki, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This is a buyer's market for steel consumers. Car makers, oil and gas drilling outfits, they've got their pick of who they want to buy their steel from. American steelmakers, which have been waiting for a pickup for years now, or foreign importers, cheaper foreign importers. From WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio, Brian Bull has that story.
Inside U.S. Steel's plants in Lorain, Ohio, steel tubes are cast, trimmed, and threaded. The freshly cast tubes are a dazzling neon orange, like a lightsaber from Star Wars.
Here at Lorain Tubular, we've made significant investments over the last 3 to 4 years to about $200 million.
Plant manager John Wilkinson says that's largely in response to the oil and gas boom from the Marcellus Shale development. But another big reason was that the Chinese had backed off from dumping its steel into the market in 2009 after several trade cases were filed. Wilkinson says after that, the company was feeling pretty good about things.
During that time frame, we now have seen the Korean imports start to take the place of the Chinese and actually exceed the levels that they were at during that time frame.
In other words, it's now South Korea that's doing the dumping, and the oil companies are all too willing to buy this cheap steel. Wilkinson says because of that, production at U.S. Steel's Lorain plants is just a third of what it could be. There's just not enough demand for its steel tubes.
This facility here would usually run around the clock, 24/7. A lot of these countries that are jumping into our market, I can't even make the product for what they're selling.
The Economic Policy Institute looked at this trend and saw that steel imports shot up 26% in the first 3 months of this year. Right now, there's 34,000 steel jobs in Ohio, but if this dumping continues, there's concern that plants will close. Rob Scott is an economist with the EPI.
China and South Korea and India and others have been investing in surplus steel capacity. We now have over 500 million tons of surplus steel production capacity. Much of that is generating steel that's being dumped on the United States. And as a result, steel producers have begun to lay off workers.
U.S. Steel blames dumping for its decision to idle plants in Texas and Pennsylvania.
Once you lose the steel mill and it shutters, it's pretty hard to bring it back.
Ned Hill is an economist at Cleveland State University. He says not only are foreign companies selling cheap steel here in the U.S., there are claims that they're also making knockoff steel for global buyers.
Every tube that comes out of a U.S. steel plant has a stamp that indicates the quality, and there have been charges that those stamps have been forged internationally. And if you have a weak piece of pipe, that can cause problems.
Meanwhile, U.S. Steel has filed suit against South Korea for circumventing fair trade laws, with the U.S. Department of Commerce expected to hand down a ruling by mid-July. In Lorain, Ohio, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
There are three items from the World Cup on which to update you right now. Well, update's the wrong word, since you probably did what I did today, took 2 hours in whatever time zone you are in to watch the U.S. lose to Germany, yet still somehow advance to the knockout round. So that is one thing. Item number two, Uruguay's Luis Suarez is gone for the rest of the tournament and has been banned for 4 months for that bizarre biting thing the other day. And finally, number three, the underwear incident. Brazil star player Neymar whipped off his shirt after a game earlier this week, revealing some colorful undershorts. Unsanctioned undershorts, apparently. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
The offending underwear was hard to miss, a kind of tie-dyed mix of Brazil's national colors, blue, green, and yellow. Brazilian media report the undies did not come courtesy of the Brazilian team's sponsor, Nike, or FIFA's official sponsor, Adidas, but from a design house called Blue Man, which sent a pair to everyone on the team.
You know, they don't think about it nearly as much as the sponsor who's paying millions of dollars.
John Horan is the publisher of Sporting Goods Intelligence. He says sponsors spend gobs of money in exchange for brand visibility at sporting events, and sports associations are zealous about making sure players wear sanctioned clothing and equipment. A couple years ago, a Danish soccer player also caught flack for flashing non-sanctioned undies at a match. He got fined more than $100,000.
They've all been read the Riot Act about this stuff.
FIFA waved this off today. The organization said it isn't in a position to, quote, provide detailed individual feedback on every potential ambush marketing incident, unquote. It regards Neymar's slip as incidental exposure. Daniel Durbin is director of the USC Annenberg Institute of Sports, Media, and Society.
There's no absolute proof that he was attempting to market another brand.
Durbin says what really gets athletes in trouble is when they use their exposure to promote brands that haven't paid to be in the game. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today about which two things. Number one, I am reluctant to criticize other broadcast journalists for questions they ask in interviews because I've been there, honestly. Number two, context is always important. So I'm going to play you this clip of Matt Lauer interviewing Mary Barra on the Today Show today. She is, of course, the CEO of General Motors, which has been having a rough go of it of late, as we said up at the top of the program. So I'm going to play this clip, but before I do, the context is that right before Lauer asked her this question you're going to hear, he asked her in almost this many words if she got the job because she's a woman. So here was the follow-up.
You're a mom, I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Two kids. You said in an interview not long ago that your kids said they're going to hold you accountable for one job, mm-hmm. and that is being a mom.
Correct.
Given the pressures of this job mm-hmm. at General Motors, can you do both well?
You know, I think I can. I have a great team. We're on the right path. We're doing the right things. We're taking accountability. And also, I have a wonderful family, a supportive husband, and I'm pretty proud of my kids the way they're supporting me in this.
And we are going to leave it there. That is Marketplace from APM on this Thursday. Today, the Dow off a 10th percent, about 21 points. The NASDAQ was flat. The S&P 500 down a 10%. That is 2 points there. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.